Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and on today's show, we will talk with Brooke Medina of the Civitas Institute about the Texas church shooting and how in times of tragedy, some groups jump to political rhetoric on others when those affected are just beginning to grieve the losses and injuries to their friends and family. And we will talk about what we believe is more the right path to take when tragedy like this strikes. But before we get to that, I want to talk about subscribing to the show. If you're not subscribed to the show, you're missing out on the easiest way to get the show to your device, whether it's your phone, your laptop, your computer, your tablet, however you're listening to the show. If you're not subscribed, you're adding more effort than need be to yourself. All you have to do to subscribe is go to where you listen to podcasts, whether it's at Apple Podcasts if you're an Apple user, or whether it's a different Android app, and just search for What Matters in North Carolina, and you will find the show there. Also, follow along with us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, by searching What Matters NC. And then also, do not forget about our call-in line, where you can call in, leave us a message, a quick minute or two, concise, clean message about what you'd like us to talk about, commenting on something we already talked about, if you have something you just want to rant about. If it is clean, good, concise, we will play it on the air. And that number, again, is 919-747-8063. Again, that's 919-747-8063. Without any further ado, we'll get to our segment with Brooke Medina. Brooke, thanks for coming back on the show.
Glad to be here, Matt.
So we are going to talk about, as we usually do, we're going to talk about a current event. And of course, on the minds of everyone is the Texas church shooting that happened on Sunday morning. And 26 lives lost, I think, is still the most up-to-date number. Is that correct?
Actually, I was looking into that, and they were not counting the unborn child. So 27 lives actually lost.
I did not realize that there actually was a pregnant woman who was killed.
Yes, she was in her third trimester.
I didn't hear about that one, actually. I knew about the 5-year-old girl, but
and an 18-month-old too, I believe, is the youngest born child. It's just tragedy. There's what really can you say about that? Our hearts are broken for these families that are reeling from this, and we're praying for them, for comfort for them.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine having, a 21-month-old daughter, right there in that same age. It's you can't imagine that, because you worry. I mean, you worry while your wife is pregnant, or while you are pregnant, you worry, and then you have this little tiny baby, and you're saying, okay, we got to be careful. We got to make sure we have the car seat in perfect. We got to make sure we have, we're everything's safe. That the baby's not going to choke on something. That you're sizing up food at appropriate intervals, and you're cutting the grapes into 4 pieces, and you start to kind of, you get to where you can give her a chicken tender and she's going to be okay, and then you're in church and something happens out of your control.
Yeah, that's the thing. As parents, if you've got a child, basically that they are your heart walking outside of your body. And when you put yourself in the shoes of those parents, including the pastor and his wife who lost their youngest daughter, who was 14 years old. Well, I have a 14-year-old as well. And just thinking about that, and the grief and the waves of grief that will continue to come over the years for these families, just, it is nothing short of heartbreaking. And so we want to make sure that, we convey our condolences and that desire for comfort for these people, and whatever measure of comfort can be found in this tragedy.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing you can't stay in that headspace too long. I mean, you just can't put yourself in those shoes for too long, or you're gonna get stuck in it. I mean, you gotta, I guess, step through it and kind of get to what we need to talk about. I definitely can't stay there. So but the issue now, so the issue that is being brought up right after this, I mean, I guess my issue is how quickly this issue gets brought up, is the gun control debate. I mean, it is immediately brought up, and really by the left, mm-hmm. brings up, this is such a tragedy, and in the same breath, we need to do some more gun control. We need to push this agenda. I mean, in the very same breath.
Yeah, well, they see it as part and parcel. I believe, from what I can tell, the mentality primarily stems from this belief that if we eradicate guns or limit them in some way that they think is actually going to adequately prevent these things from happening, that violence or mass killings will no longer exist. That's clearly not the case. Look at Europe and look at the places all across Europe that have banned guns. And you still see, hey, what happened in Nice, France? Yeah, they took a huge truck.
What happened
running
in New York
over
City?
Children in New York City, running over children in strollers. This has a lot more to do with the state of our society, the value or the devaluation of human beings. That doesn't mean that there are never things that we can talk about on the policy front that can help protect people. But we need to come at it with some common sense and, a healthy humility that you cannot predict behaviors all the time. I mean, we can see signs, and we need to be, conscious of that as everyday citizens, even to watch for signs and to be aware. And so we're not brushing that off at all. But we also need to use wisdom and recognize as well who stopped the shooter. It was a former NRA instructor,
right,
that had an AR-15, I believe. So,
right, there's so much in there we need to get to. But starting first, I want to talk about this belief that we can make a law or a different law about guns that'll just totally flip the script and change this. And you're right, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't work that way. You ban private ownership of guns or most guns in England, you get stabbing attacks. In China, the same way, people are using knives. They're using the next best thing. New York City, very hard to get a permit to carry a gun, very hard to get certain types of guns. Guy rents the truck and drives it down the road for, I mean, a couple of miles or a mile or so on the sidewalk, killing people. I mean, in Nice, France, just going down the waterfront in this festival with a big box truck running people over. I mean, the fact is that this is, someone who's intent on carrying out an attack is going to carry out that attack. They are going to find a way to carry out that attack. They say, so-and-so amount, look at suicide, so-and-so amount of suicides happen with guns, so we should ban guns. People who are intent on killing themselves are going to find a way to kill themselves, whether it is with overuse of medication, hanging, whatever they're going to do, they're going to find a way to kill themselves if they want to, or someone who's intent on attacking people is going to find a way to do that. Mm-hmm. So no regulation on guns is going to stop that. So, I mean, it's like the war on drugs. Heroin's illegal. Methamphetamine's illegal. Cocaine's illegal. Marijuana is illegal in most places. It's still being used in every place that it's illegal. It is still being used. It is pervasive. People who know how to get it can get it. And the law doesn't stop that. So why would we be so naive to think that a law against guns or a new law against guns is going to stop this? And it won't, is the simple answer. But we can identify a common thread between the Las Vegas shooting and this church shooting and Sandy Hook, where what, 28 first graders were killed. We can identify a common thread all the way back to Columbine. There has been a common thread in the theater shooting in where was this one?
Charleston, Dylan Roof shooting.
No, the Dylan Roof shooting in the church there. There was the theater shooting in the name of the town escapes me.
In Denver?
Tuscarora, I think it was. But then all of these have a very common thread, and it is mental health is the issue. It is not, it's not the gun. It's not the gun. Guns, I mean, this is a very good example of a gun used by a good person, an NRA, who was an NRA instructor, a law-abiding gun owner, stepped in to help, mm-hmm, successfully. And so if you want to demonize the gun, and there are people, people who are on the left right now screaming for gun control want to take away the AR-15s currently today and say he had an AR-15. They want to take away this. That was used by a good guy to stop this. That's a fact. That's an unavoidable fact if you want to get into this discussion to say here is what was used and what helped. The gun is not bad. The person with mental health issues, who has a history of mental health issues, had dishonorable discharge from the Air Force, multiple things on his record to say this guy has issues. And yet, so was it legal for him to have the guns that he had? No. My understanding is it was not legal for him to have those guns or that gun. But he had it. He went outside the law. So what law laid on law-abiding citizens would have prevented him from having that? So again, it's a two-pronged argument. We got to catch people beforehand in the mental health system. We have to catch these dangerous people. We have to catch these
people. And we had a system in place, but the Air Force failed to, submit his information to the FBI system. And so, the thing is, if you have a system in place, but you're not actually using it, it's going to be a problem too, right?
Yeah, let's use the system that's in place before we go and start talking about new regulations. For sure, we definitely need to do that. But this is a two-pronged thing. There's a failure in the system here to catch this issue. But if you look at the other side and go, okay, good guys with guns were there outside the church. What if there had been someone carrying in the church or multiple people carrying in the church when it happened? Or we talk about these other shootings where they happen. They happen in gun-free zones. And I don't know if this church, I know in North Carolina the way the law works currently. So my church operates a preschool. So under the law, my church is a no-go zone for concealed carry because there is a school being operated on a part-time basis there. There was a law that would have changed that, or a bill that would have changed that. It didn't make it through in the last session, but currently
isn't that
that's
during,
the way it
only
is.
Only during like the preschool hours?
It's not.
Okay.
The bill would have made it so it was only during the school hours. But as the law is written, my church is a no-go zone. So if you change that, you open up more. Again, this is North Carolina based. This is not about Texas's law. But if you open up more areas to the ability for people to conceal firearms, you take away what I would call safe zones for shooters. Mm-hmm. They are safe zones for shooters. Malls are safe zones for shooters. They're gun-free zones, apparently. And that just means good for crime, good for killers, good for criminals. That's what it means to me, is that, I know that there's not going to be a lot of people with guns here. There might be some who do it anyway, but the vast majority of people here will be unarmed. That's what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and just to kind of follow up on that point regarding, the need for us to be more level-headed about where we're making these safe zones and how they pose a vulnerability for innocent people. If you are going to conceal carry and we do roll back these safe zones or gun-free zones, those who do have concealed licenses need to be proficient in what they're doing. So Kyle Lamb, he's a former Special Forces operator, and he's retired now, but he wrote in the Federalist about just the importance of, if you're going to have a concealed carry, it comes with a great responsibility. And I know you advocate for this too. Be a responsible gun owner and be prepared, because there may come a day when you are called into action and you have to respond, and you want to be able to respond the best that you can. So, be a responsible gun owner by regularly, going to the range and practicing and being aware of the laws.
Oh, definitely. I mean, 100%. If you accept the responsibility of getting your concealed handgun permit, I mean, North Carolina, it's a concealed handgun permit. Other states call it different things. But if you get your CHP, you're making a decision for your life, for your loved ones, that you are going to accept the responsibility of it. Now, you can get your CHP and leave it in a drawer with your handgun and not carry it and not worry about it if you want to. But if you do make the decision to carry that gun, you have to know how to use it. You have to know about how to shoot that firearm safely. You have to know about the fact that if you shoot a person who's right in front of you, you have to worry about what's behind that person in case you miss, in case it goes through. You have to understand when you can use your firearm, what constitutes a good shoot versus a bad shoot, because you don't want to end up in handcuffs because you thought you had the right to do something that you didn't have the right to do. I mean, you have to know where you can and can't carry. You have to understand the laws. And there, caveat, there are people who advocate for the following and carrying wherever they want to despite the law, but even those people need to know the law, and I'm not advocating for that at all, but I mean, everyone who wants to carry needs to know the law, but even above that, be safe with your firearm, because you just can't, like, the cost is too high. But responsible gun owners understand that. That's the other thing, is that the people who are responsible, they know this, they do practice, they go to the range, they practice, they go to courses above and beyond the required 8 hours, which is, I mean, if you know zero about a gun, nothing, that course is probably a good starting point, I guess. But me, as a lifetime, you know, around firearms, hunting, you know, that sort of thing, recreationally, I didn't learn anything in there. But there are courses above and beyond that, handgun courses, concealed carry courses, all sorts of different courses that all shooters should want to take. I want to take these courses. I would love to have all the time and money in the world to take all these courses I could, but it's just got to be a personal responsibility. And that is the thing that gun owners, I believe, do well, which kind of brings us into the next thing that we really want to talk about, was say, what can we do otherwise from a policy standpoint? If you want to approach policy, not a reactionary policy, mm-hmm. not a ineffective policy. So first, I would say from policy standpoint, we need to evaluate the mental health system we have in place. We need to evaluate that system of, again, is it being used, which it would seem there was a hole there with the Air Force not reporting this to the FBI, as they should have, this information. And then if it is going to be used, or if it is used, is it enough?
Right. And how do you evaluate a mental health problem? That's another thing. I mean, that there are varying degrees of those. People respond differently. And, you know, as a conservative, we tend to be a little bit skeptical of the different ways in which the government decides and makes these decisions of what constitutes a mental health problem. Is it disagreeing with the powers that be that makes a mental health problem? So, you know, there's all these things that have to be taken into account when creating new policy, or at least enforcing the policy that's in place. And we have to think long term about that, because there may be a pro Second Amendment president in the White House right now, but that doesn't guarantee that there will be, you know, next election cycle or the subsequent ones. And so justice and law need to be, they need to provide equal opportunity to those who are willing to abide by the law without arbitrary and subjective definitions floating around of what constitutes mental health issue too. So there are some things that are very, very clear. Obviously this man, did have a mental health issue and anger issues at that. I mean, he was dishonorably discharged from the Air Force for assaulting his wife and her child. I don't know if it was both of their children.
Which
child.
That right there, for me, that's enough to say, okay, you don't need to have a gun.
Absolutely.
You weren't discharged for something that's unrelated to your, you know, mental state or violent or a violent aspect. Like, if you got a dishonorable discharge for you popped on a drug test, you know, smoking pot, I'm not, like, I don't think smoking pot makes you unable to own a firearm. I don't. But this is, you know, something violent.
Correct.
There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, we
common
have to.
Common sense here.
Exactly. We have to have a certain, like, understanding. Like, if you have a history of all these different mental things versus, like, one time, if you had stress, a stress incident or whatever you want to call it, and it was a single isolated thing versus, like, a history of it, common sense says maybe we look at the history, not the one time, and just blanket over this entire, like, if you've ever had this one little thing happen, you can't. Like, as conservatives, we tend to err on the side of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that kind of goes into how I look at not just the mental health side, but the other side, you know, the gun, the access to firearms side. And we were talking about this yesterday, or this week before ahead of this segment. And what I've always said is, you know, I'm not sure we have to do anything in North Carolina to keep these, you know, keep people who shouldn't have guns from having them that we can do. I mean, we can't stop criminals from getting guns. We can't stop someone who's willing to break the law from getting a gun by changing the law on its face. I mean, they're going to steal the gun. They're going to get it from off the street. They're going to get guns if they can, if they're really intent on it. But there is a way, I believe, we can stop people who shouldn't have a gun from getting it from a law-abiding citizen. Because I, as a law-abiding citizen, there can conceivably sell a gun to someone who shouldn't have it without ever knowing it, without ever knowing that I've done something wrong, without having any way of knowing I've done something wrong. So in North Carolina, the bar to sell privately a long gun, a rifle or a shotgun, is you have a North Carolina driver's license. I can sell a gun personally to another North Carolinian who is eligible to have that firearm. Now, how do I know they're eligible? There's no surefire way beyond doing that transfer in a gun store, paying the gun store to transfer the firearm, there's no other way to do it. There's really no other way to do it. I literally would have to go down to whatever gun shop down in Clayton, where I am, and say, all right, meet me here, and we're going to have Rob transfer the gun between us. And that way he can check you out. But I, as a private citizen, who covers that cost? If I'm the one demanding it, I would say I would cover that cost. And so that cuts into what I'm getting from the gun for on the one hand, but also it's a hassle, and it makes it difficult. And a lot of people, some people don't want to go through that process. But I think if we were allowed access as private citizens to the National Instant Criminal Background Check system that is maintained by the FBI, the yes or no, go or no go system, to say, can Brooke, driver's license number 12345678 9, own a firearm? Is she eligible for this? And they go, yes. Okay, cool. Sell it to you. They go, no. I go, all right, sorry, Brooke, I can't sell you this gun. And I mean, it sounds simple, but we're not allowed access. Right. Private citizens aren't allowed access to that system.
And I think it's a really good point that you bring up regarding just that being a simple policy solution that does not overstep too many boundaries. I mean, you are giving up an element of privacy there.
You're giving up, yeah, the element of saying, I am interested in selling a gun to this person. And again, you can make the argument of, you know, well, let's say that you had to say what gun it was, and then it's like a registry of who's got what gun. And you say, well, you don't have to say what gun it is. So if you craft it in that way.
Right. Yeah. But, so you would have to be careful about that. But honestly, I don't, and you are definitely more schooled on this topic than I am. But it, to me, that makes sense to at least have access to that database that you're saying gun stores already have access to.
Right, gun stores have access and have to use this database.
Right, and provide it for private gun sellers. Because as you had mentioned when we were discussing this the other day, it was no law-abiding citizen that actually cares about people is going to want to sell a gun to someone that has nefarious motives. And so we would love the opportunity to be able to vet these people just at the most basic level. Yes, no, go, no go.
Oh, exactly. And I don't need to know their life story. I don't need to know anything about them. I just, and again, I'm not even saying make it mandatory. I'm not even saying force people to do it. I'm saying make it voluntarily. Make it voluntary. You can just do it if you want to. And so many gun owners will do it because the vast majority of gun owners are responsible people who don't want a bad thing to be done with a gun, with any gun. I mean, a gun that they've owned or any gun at all. Especially, I mean, so let's say I went and bought this gun new in the store. I go and sell it to Joe Blow. He goes and uses it for something bad. And they go, well, this gun ties back to him. It's like, well, I don't want something bad happening with this gun that I at some point own for sure.
Yes. And well, and I think this is the part that a lot of those who push heavy gun control legislation fail to realize is there are so many Americans that pro-Second Amendment Americans that our desire for keeping and preserving the Second Amendment is because we love the people in this country, even if we disagree with them. We love them and we want to make sure that people are safe. And we know that the best way to stop a bad guy is with a good guy or gal with a gun. And not to mention, when I say gal, that makes me think, you know, coming from the position of a woman, a gun and having a concealed carry, it's an equalizer for us females. And so just thinking about women that have been in domestic violence situations, they desire that added layer of protection and to further restrict their access to those firearms is doing a great disservice to them.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we say it before, the only thing that allows a 100-pound woman and a 250-pound man to be on equal footing is the gun. That is the great equalizer between them and allows that woman to possibly save her own life.
Yep.
And well, thank you for coming on the show and talking with us about it.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you to Brooke, and thank you to you for listening to the show, all of you out there who come back every week. And definitely make sure you're subscribing to the show. Follow along on social media on Facebook and Twitter. Again, search What Matters in North Carolina to subscribe to the show. Search What Matters in C to follow along on social media on Facebook and Twitter. Call into that call-in line at 919-747-8063 if you have some thoughts on the Texas shooting or the political rhetoric and fallout of the shooting or anything really in that sphere. If you want to leave us a message about that, again, the number is 919-747-8063, and we'll catch you next time.